Moody's Analytics will host its second annual Ag Day virtual conference dedicated to the discussion of agriculture. Ag lending professionals come together for 2 days of peer sharing, best practice concepts, and critical insight into agriculture's road ahead. Learn more at moodysanalytics.com/Moody's Ag Day 2021.
Hey, everybody, I'm Paul Yeager. This is the MTOM Show podcast in big kid form. Take a look at this. We got pants. We got a tie. We're at the set. We're in the studio. We've got cameras. My thanks to the crew that put this together this week as we talk about transportation. Hurricane Ida came ashore almost to the exact minute of Katrina. Ida left a major impact. What has been learned in that time? What was the damage of Ida this time? We know how it impacted a grain facility of Cargill's in Louisiana. But Mike Steenhook, who is the executive director of the Soy Transportation Coalition, he pays attention to what goes on there in New Orleans, just like he does in the Pacific Northwest and other places where American farmers' goods, specifically soybeans, go as they head to foreign ports. So we are going to talk about infrastructure. We're going to talk about the needs of the farmer when it comes to water transportation and other infrastructure issues as we get that grain from the field to the export area. That is this installment of the MTOM Show podcast. Take it away. Which weather forecast frightens you the most? The one that comes in September because of the hurricanes? Or do you still get worried about like a winter storm?
Well, the real big concern is when you've got a pretty seismic weather event in the Gulf of Mexico right when our harvest season is coming online. So you've got all of this volume that soybean farmers and grain farmers are producing. You've got robust demand, particularly international. But then you've got this area of the country called the Lower Mississippi River that accounts for 61% of U.S. soybean exports, 58% of corn exports, by far the number one launching point for both commodities. And so all of a sudden, if you have a disruption at that area, supply and demand can't connect, and they just look at each other, and the transaction will never occur. So that's the real concern, particularly as hurricane season can certainly extend into the fall when our harvest comes online and our export program really elevates.
But your seat is in Iowa. Are you watching National Weather Service forecasts, or do you have some type of weather service that you look at just so you know what's going on in those regions?
Well, we follow the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. They do a really good job of providing that forecast. But one of the things that Hurricane Ida really demonstrated and reminded us of is these weather events can really percolate in a very quick period of time. Yeah, Hurricane Ida was on people's radar screen really on that Thursday, August 26th, and then all of a sudden on Saturday, August 28th, that's when the channel was shut down. So you had a storm that really emerged in the Gulf of Mexico. It didn't emerge off the western coast of Africa and meander its way across the Atlantic Ocean. It really just all of a sudden percolated in the Gulf of Mexico. It got this really major shot of adrenaline, this warm water off the coast of the United States, and all of a sudden we have a Category 4 hurricane. So, you know, you can certainly monitor weather forecasts, but again, one of the things that we were reminded of with Hurricane Ida is these things can really emerge in a very short period of time.
Severity is one thing. Is there a location from a grain belt perspective that causes more concern than another?
Well, you just look at our launching points for these commodities like soybeans, which is the number one ag export from the United States. So you look at the Lower Mississippi River, which is number one. We've got 14 soybean and grain export facilities that are located along that stretch of the river from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, past New Orleans into the Gulf of Mexico. So unfortunately, that's also an area that's suspect for hurricane activity. So you can have these kind of disruptions. So that's the area that's clearly of the biggest concern. The Pacific Northwest is the number two launching point for soybeans and for other commodities. So that's clearly important as well. But when you look at where our exports are launched from and what area of the country can have these major weather events, the Mississippi Gulf region clearly is the top of the list.
And I'm guessing when it's New Orleans, that's probably target one. A level one, or however you want to say, most severe is the most concerning.
It is, because you have such volume that goes out of that area. And naturally, you've got these big soybean-producing and grain-producing states like Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, et cetera, that they are adjacent to the inland waterway system. So it's very natural and efficient to move these products via barge down to the New Orleans area, where they are in turn are loaded onto ocean vessels, and then they get dispatched throughout the world, oftentimes to Asia. So clearly that's a very important area. And one of the things that I always try to underscore is what happens down there impacts what happens up here. And what happens up here impacts what happens down there. These are two areas of the country that are very inextricably linked.
Has that changed, though, over time, as water has maybe not been the primary use of moving some grain from the grain belt? Maybe rail has become a bigger thing, maybe truck, or it's just not flat out making it past an ethanol plant that's closer in the neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen more and more corn being devoted to ethanol over the last decade plus. One of the things that has emerged over the last 15 years is more and more soybeans being produced in states like North Dakota, western Minnesota, South Dakota. And those are areas of the country that are far removed from the inland waterway system. So the natural route for those soybeans produced in that region of the country is rail to the Pacific Northwest, like the Portland, Oregon area, Seattle, Washington. And then, of course, with the significant rise of consumption from places like China, it's very natural for those soybeans to be railed to that area, then put onto an ocean vessel, and then sent across the Pacific Ocean. But for those states that are still in the middle of the country, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, et cetera, barge transportation is really the most efficient way of get product to market, and then having those export facilities down in the New Orleans area. It's a reason why there's a reason why the Mississippi Gulf remains such the preeminent launching point for our export program.
When was the peak for New Orleans to be the port of heading out?
It's been consistently number one for many, many years. You know, we have seen more and more devoted to the Pacific Northwest. But when you look at overall terms of volume, the Mississippi Gulf region is the preeminent launching point, and it's been that way for a number of years. And we anticipate it'll be that way for years to come.
Market share is always a discussion for many things. I'm guessing grain shipping is one. Listening to you talk, it maybe sounds like the Pacific Northwest has picked up some of that market share. Yes, it might not be number one. Has it been a good thing, given the hurricane hitting, or any hurricane that hits in that Delta region, that maybe the PNW is a destination of South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana?
Well, one of the cardinal rules when it comes to supply chain is don't put all your eggs in one basket. The more you can diversify the number of routes to your ultimate customer, the number of modes of transportation that you can avail yourself of, the better you are as an industry. So yes, we have appreciated the growth and the rise of Pacific Northwest as far as meeting our export demand. You know, we're always encouraging more exports out of the Atlantic coast, even places like the Texas Gulf and the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Great Lakes system. These other gateways are not going to ever rival the Mississippi Gulf or the Pacific Northwest. But again, the more you can diversify, the more you can have resilience and redundancy, the better positioned you are as an industry.
What's your travel been like down to that region in the past? So you know intimately, oh, that cargo facility, losing it was a big deal. How much do you know about that region without having to rely on somebody else giving you information? You just see where the severest points were to how it responds to the farmers.
Yeah, it's been a very important area for me personally to get down to on a routine basis. It is clearly that the profitability of farmers in the Midwest is so strongly linked to how functional our export capacity is on the lower Mississippi River. So it's very important for someone like me to be well acquainted with it. So even before the hurricane hit, the big concerns that I had are yes, the facilities themselves, the storage facilities, but it's the conveyance system that links the storage facilities that ultimately is used for loading an ocean vessel. That's the more fragile elements of these export facilities that are along the lower Mississippi River. And so when all of a sudden you've got 150 mile an hour sustained wind, the worry was that that's where the damage would emerge. And certainly we saw that with the Cargill facility. That's about 30 miles northwest of New Orleans. And, you know, the big million-dollar question is, how long will it take for that facility to get restored? That facility alone probably accounts to 7 to 8% of soybean exports. So, you know, when you've got a lot of pad in your system, having a facility go down like that can be sustainable. But when you've got strong volumes being generated by farmers, strong export demand, you really need your supply chain to be operating on all cylinders. And when that doesn't happen, you fall victim to the scenario that I always try to warn about, is you never want to be in the business of attaching a garden hose to a fire hydrant. You know, the good news is that you've got this volume produced by farmers, you've got great international demand, but if you want to be profitable, you want to attach a fire hose to a fire hydrant. You don't want to attach a garden hose to a fire hydrant. And so when your export capacity is not operating at full throttle, you fall victim to that scenario. And then the result is the industry becomes less profitable, your supply chain becomes less reliable.
You sound like you want to talk about infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Is that aging infrastructure? I mean, how fragile was this area you're talking about, this cargo facility, other facilities like it? How long has it been in a susceptible position to a storm of 150 mile an hour winds?
Well, the good news is that these facilities and those who manage them, they're aware that hurricanes arrive in the Gulf area. So they build these facilities and they maintain them with a sense of resiliency and redundancy in mind. They design it to be able to absorb a punch. But I think the point is, 150 mile an hour sustained wind that Hurricane Ida produced is quite a punch. So you're not going to be able to emerge from that without some kind of damage. So that's kind of the reality. Now, more broadly speaking, when it comes to our national infrastructure, the United States can increasingly be described as a spending nation, not an investing nation. And there's a big difference between the two. We in this country, we like to expend resources today in exchange for immediate gratification. That's what spending is. When you invest, you expend resources today in exchange for value tomorrow and the next week and beyond that. That's what investing is. And we need to recapture more of an investment mentality. It certainly was more manifest years ago when we built the interstate highway system and preceding that, the Transcontinental Railroad and all of these things that have provided exceptional benefit to the U.S. economy for years. We need to recapture that. And so certainly that means things like, you know, enhancing and maintaining the lower Mississippi River, that whole multimodal transportation system, not only for agriculture, but for the broader economy. We need to be more attentive to that.
You've worked for a senator. You've worked in Washington, D.C. for a number of years. You know how a political system can be hard to navigate when it is a bill like this. It looks like, I mean, President Trump talked about infrastructure all the time, but there wasn't much of a bill that came forward until early in this administration. Mm-hmm. What's the likelihood and let's start with that. What's the likelihood that an infrastructure bill is going to get passed in the next 6 months?
Well, I'm always hesitant to be bullish on the Congress and Washington, D.C. doing the right thing. But I am very hopeful that we will see an infrastructure bill actually get passed. It was a very strong signal when the Senate in early August passed the bipartisan infrastructure plan by a vote of 69 to 30 with 19 Republican senators. So that is a pretty strong bipartisan level support, especially given how contentious Washington, D.C. is. Now, the big question mark is what happens in the House. And the question is, do they pass something, that infrastructure bill, more in isolation? Or do they lump it together and make it a package deal with this more controversial social spending that's a part of that budget reconciliation proposal? And, you know, what I think, it is clearly a priority of the president. We've had that strong level support from the Senate. I do think that we will see something emerge from the House of Representatives, but then the question is how elongated this process is. You know, no bill is perfect, and clearly there's room for critique of the infrastructure bill. But, you know, the bottom line is if that bill does get passed, we will see new roads get built. We will see new bridges getting built, including many in rural areas. We will see our inland waterway system get enhanced. And that's really one of the beauties of infrastructure compared to so many of these other things that Washington, D.C. spends money on, where a lot of times people scratch their heads and they say, you know, I know we spent money on this. It's hard for me to see the value that that spending provided to the American people. When you actually build a bridge or a road, you can actually point to it. You can drive over it. And you can. It becomes more easily to be able to determine and conclude, well, this is actually providing value to me as an American taxpayer and to our broader economy. So I think that's one of the real beauties of infrastructure investment.
Well, let's go back to earlier this year when there was an issue in Memphis where a bridge over the Mississippi there had damage. But if you look at the pictures, the common eye goes, I don't see anything wrong. Mm-hmm. So how is the how do you tell someone like me who doesn't understand the engineering of how a bridge works, why it's A, it's broken, B, it needs to be fixed, and C, it needs to be done yesterday?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we need to do a better job of is maintaining these assets once they've been built. It's very compelling to have the ribbon cutting moment when the new bridge was built, but it's less sexy to actually maintain it. And that's one of the problems that we have. So we need to do a better job of that. You know, the reality with infrastructure is you don't really notice it until it's not working. And that's just really, that's one of the dilemmas for those who advocate for infrastructure, is that it's hard for people to get really energized by it until there's actually a problem. So what I and others need to do is to try to portray the consequences of not investing in as vivid of a way as possible before the problem occurs, not after the problem occurs. So, you know, the bridge collapse and the bridge closure in Memphis that actually is now reopened, there was a structural problem at one of the key weight-bearing elements of the bridge. And not only did that impact vehicular traffic going across the interstate, Interstate 40, from Memphis into Arkansas, but it actually resulted in a river closure for 3 days. And over that 3-day period of time, 1,000 barges accumulated in a line to transit that part of the river. So you really see how linked these systems are. And one of the big takeaways I had, or at least reminders from that situation, is the interstate system is the flagship part of our surface transportation system. If we've got those kind of problems emerging with the interstate system, how much more profound are the problems on the state and the rural system? And they are quite significant. So we've got a lot of work to do on that.
Well, I'll know from my grain that that semi that leaves the field that goes to somewhere else, I see that semi leave. I might not see that barge go by from Dubuque down to, you know, Keokuk on down to Memphis. I worked in Davenport for a number of years, followed the locks and dams there, and I know you know lock and dams pretty well. You could probably name them all if we played a quiz. Mm-hmm. Let's do it now. I'm just kidding. Why is water transportation, specifically on the Mississippi, upper, middle, lower? What's the biggest need for that region? Because it's still right in the heart of grain country. Why does something need to be done? What's the biggest need?
Well, it's integral to our success. You know, so when you look at a truck carrying soybeans, that truck will be accommodating about 900 bushels of soybeans per load. One 15 barge tow or flotilla, when you're attaching 15 barges together, can easily accommodate 850,000 bushels. So it's very successful at transporting heavy commodities like soybeans and grain long distances at an economical and environmentally sustainable manner. But unfortunately, unless you really routinely encounter the river, you really won't know what a barge is. You may not have never seen one. So it's only those people who live on river communities that have this acquaintance with it and maybe appreciation of it. So we've got to continue within agriculture is telling that story, that it's really key to our competitiveness internationally and how the profitability of farmers here is strongly a function of how well maintained and capitalized that inland waterway system is with those locks and dams. So there's a number of locks that are on the upper Mississippi River. There's some specifically north of St. Louis that are priorities for Midwest agriculture that we would like to see expanded from its current size to something larger.
Let's say longer or wider?
It would actually be longer. Okay. So then you can, it just makes it the transportation more efficient. You don't have to break these tows or flotillas in half to work them through each time you encounter a lock. So if you have these expanded lock chambers, it's just much more efficient, much more timely. So there's some of those that are priorities for us. But then also, we have long advocated for, let's also take care of what we have. The good news about locks and dams is the technology has been pretty consistent for about 200 years. These locks, it's just simply a matter of a concrete chamber, gates, and valves that regulate the water flow in and out. And so the good news is, if you take care of what you have, you can dramatically elongate the useful life of them. So we need to do a better job of that. That's always been a big priority of our organization. And I try to remember the Panama Canal, which was first opened to traffic in 1914, well over 100 years ago. And they've done a good job of just maintaining that system. You know, there's been a lot of notoriety about the new locks down at the Panama Canal, but the ones that were open in 1914 are still the workhorse of the Panama Canal Authority. But it's because they maintain the system. So we think it's entirely appropriate for an organization like ours that's funded by and led by farmers. Farmers have part of their brand ID is stewardship, taking care of what you have. And so we think we're a very effective messenger about applying that same approach to maintaining and improving our infrastructure. Let's also take care of what we have. Let's practice good stewardship.
It's just not cheap to do either. And that's the hard thing to remember. Whether I'm writing a check to a check off, which is lobbying on behalf of a certain bill, or maybe I'm having a premium cut off of my grain sold so that we can expand. It's just someone has to eventually pay for it if we're going to continue to use it.
Yeah, and so infrastructure is very expensive. We always need to be pushing for opportunities to get more bang for our buck. There are a lot of innovations out there that can allow us to make the taxpayer dollar stretch further. An initiative that we're working on right now relates to rural bridges. And, you know, a typical rural bridge can easily cost $500,000 to build. Well, we're promoting opportunities and innovations that can result in a bridge being built for $100,000 without sacrificing any degree of safety. So there clearly is an opportunity to make the taxpayer dollar stretch further across our various modes of transportation. But, you know, when it comes to actually paying for it, it is expensive. But that makes it more incumbent upon us to make sure that we're articulating the cost benefit. So there's the cost side, how big of a check you have to write to build a new road, bridge, lock, whatever it may be. But there are benefits to that, and that is the competitiveness of the American farmer and all of the ripple effects that result from that. You know, one of the things I like to underscore is some industries create the ripple effect, other industries ride the ripple effect. And I think the best example of an industry that's like the stone getting dropped into a pond of water that creates the ripple effect is farming. And you think about, it's not an accident that we've got all of these industries in the state of Iowa that flourish and exist in the first place because there's a group of farmers that plant a seed in the spring and they harvest it in the fall. And because that activity occurs, there's all these other industries like rural lending, manufacturing, seed technology, all of these industries that would not exist if it wasn't for the farmer. So that's all part of that story we need to tell, that yes, infrastructure is expensive, but the benefits exceed that, and that's why it merits our attention.
Did IDA highlight the biggest vulnerability that system faces on transportation from my field in South Dakota, Iowa, Minnesota, to getting it to China or Brazil or Africa? D- Did Ida highlight the biggest vulnerability, and that's the Port of New Orleans, or is there another one that we need to worry about even more?
It really highlighted, because so much volume goes out of that area, how seismic the problem would be if you had wholesale disruption there. Hurricane Katrina presented that to us 16 years ago. You know, there were farmers in the Midwest that all of a sudden saw the price that they were offered at point of sale in the middle of the country, 1,000 miles from New Orleans. All of a sudden, their price declined, not because their supply had diminished in quality, and not because there was no longer demand, but just all of a sudden the supply chain wasn't operating as it normally would be. And the whole phenomenon with agriculture is you've got these barge loading facilities on the inland waterway system, like the Mississippi River. And if these facilities can't move product out their back door because, say, the port of South Louisiana is closed by New Orleans, then those facilities will not be willing to accept product via their front door because they can't move it out. And so what they do is they'll drop the price that they offer to farmers. And so, you know, my mind immediately turns when you see these export regions close. Or say even the same phenomenon can happen as if you have an unexpected closure at a lock on the inland waterway system, is all of a sudden that translates to less money in a farmer's wallet. So it has real relevance to an individual farmer.
Well, and since Ida hit the Monday after, I mean, it was Saturdays when it made landfall. Monday's market, Sunday night's opening Monday, we've been lower consistently, corn and soybeans to an extent, wheat, since then, and we haven't really seen much of a return, and we've been running pretty good up until that point. So yes, it's a real thing about less money in the pockets of farmers right now. Lastly, as we finish up here, Mike, you talk about the biggest challenges if we don't have a place to send. What's the biggest priority for your organization as we trying to figure out this infrastructure bill? Is it something else? What's the biggest priority in the next 6 months for you?
Well, it's, you know, all of the above is kind of a scapegoat kind of question, but it really is true. You know, when you look at the journey from the farm to the ultimate customer internationally, it's comprised of a number of links. And you're always only as strong as your weakest link. And so there are challenges with our rural road and bridge inventory, our inland waterway system, our ports. You know, I always try to keep in mind that if your supply chain, if each link in your supply chain is made out of stainless steel, but only one of them is made out of a twisty tie, then you don't have an effective supply chain, even if most of the links are strong. So you have to be attentive to each of those links in the supply chain. So for us to do our job appropriately, we're going to be very attentive to rural roads and bridges and the inland waterway system and our ports. And the, you know, the moment we focus disproportionately on one, then the danger is that one of those other links could become the twisty tie, and then you don't have an effective supply chain.
All right, Mike, I appreciate your time. Iowa native, I didn't even get into your background. Iowa native, right?
Yeah, I was raised in central Iowa. My parents grew up on farms east of Des Moines, so worked for Senator Chuck Grassley for 8 years prior to doing this. So yeah, it's great to be working on behalf of Iowa and U.S. farmers.
All right. Mike Steenhook, appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
My thanks to Mike Steenhook for his time here as we discuss the transportation issues impacting the American farmer. Thank you so much for watching, listening, or reading. Hey, if you have an idea for us, hit us up at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. This has been a production of the Market to Market TV show and Iowa PBS. Thank you so very much. We'll see you next time.
Moody's Analytics will host its second annual Ag Day virtual conference dedicated to the discussion of agriculture. Ag lending professionals come together for 2 days of peer sharing, best practice concepts, and critical insight into agriculture's road ahead. Learn more at moodysanalytics.com/Moody's Ag Day 2021.